The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to So Very Wrong About Games. I'm your co-host, Mark Bigney, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Mike Walker. How are you doing, Mike?
Fantastic.
Glad to hear it. I'd just like to announce that we are now the official board gaming podcast of the 2018 Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang. We are also the unofficial podcast of people named Mark who like to make outrageous lies. With that news going forward, let us proceed with our standard agenda. We're going to talk about games we played last week. We're going to talk a little bit about the news, why it doesn't matter. We're going to talk about our feature game, and our feature game this week is Gaia Project. And then we're going to talk a little bit about a related topic, which is reskins and second editions, and our general thoughts on them, ones that were successful, ones we thought were less successful, and the general ramblings that you come to us and only us for. So with that in mind, what did you play last week, Walker?
Well, last week, Mark, we had a games day, so we played plenty of games, but it was a lot of the stuff that I've already talked about, so I'm just going to pick out ones that are new. So Stone Age. I hope this game's not untouchable, because my lord, just because it says Stone Age doesn't mean that's when it came out. It's a worker placement game that has, I think, my new worst mechanism in it, which is the hidden scoring at the end of the game, where we all finished off at around 175 points, and then someone flipped up their cards and got an additional 140 points, thereby lapping. Anyway, that's Stone Age, one of the initial worker placement games.
So you played it with the expansion style as the goal, correct?
Correct.
You told me a couple things. Now, I've played Stone Age. I'm kind of like you. I wasn't terribly enamored with it. I think it suffers from a lot of the earlier worker placement foibles that newer ones don't. Namely, in Stone Age, there are some spaces that are just wildly better than others, especially getting more people, the so-called Nookie Hut, which, you know, I appreciate as a bit of naming convention. And in Stone Age, you roll to get resources, which I don't necessarily object to dice, but it does seem to bog things down a little bit. But you told me a couple things about the expansion specifically in Stone Age that struck me as borderline egregious. You want to talk about that for a second?
Sure. They introduced these things called decorations or jewelry, and they come in the form of bone and a stock market. So you can trade in these bone for goods, and they start off at 2 bone for 1 good as long as you get started on the track. And it pretty well negated, like, the last 3 resource tracks, right? There was no reason. No one ever went to the gold space or the stone space or the clay space. Because why do that when you can just get bone and trade it in for a way better ratio? So it seemed very odd.
Your initial characterization of the Stone Age expansion was that it seemed to take away from the base game. And I'm all in favor of giving people increased flexibility, but when your expansion basically obviates the need for a lot of different tracks, that definitely doesn't seem like an advantage.
Yeah, it was odd.
Yeah. Anyway, like I say, early worker placement game, I think it's been more or less rendered obsolete by later ones. That's not to say that the older worker placement games aren't better, but it's like a lot of the immediate derivatives of Dominion that just came out after that, that hadn't quite figured out how to solve a lot of the issues, that there's not really a whole lot of reason to go back and play.
No, not in my opinion anyway.
So this was a good week in gaming for me as well. I was introduced to a fair number of new games that I was very, very impressed by. One of them was Corporate America. This was a game that was initially released about 5 years ago by Teal Frisco and Nothing Sacred Games. And I'd been wanting to try it for a while, but I'd never really had a chance to. And some of our acquaintance got the new Gilded Edition.
Yeah, no, I've been watching you guys play it. It seems very interesting. It looks like some sort of government, U.S. government abstract game. It looks very red, white, and bluish, and I'm interested to see what you think of it.
Okay, so there are two things to talk about in terms of Corporate America. There's the satire, and then there's the actual game itself. I'll start with the satire. The satire is probably one of the better satires that I've ever seen in board game form. There's a whole bunch of rules mechanisms, many of which are fine by themselves, but are rendered even better by the fact that this is a satire about money and politics in America. For example, in many other politics games, I'm thinking specifically of Democker. Democker is a game I still quite like and I will defend, and Karl-Heinz Schmiel has done a lot of good things. But in Democker, there's this process near the end of the game where, by virtue of the mechanisms, all of the party platforms kind of converge. And that's kind of unsatisfying as a political, quote-unquote, simulation of German politics. But in Corporate America, you can end up in situations where you have a number of people, quote-unquote, running for president, and their platforms are basically the same. And you as a corporation are entirely indifferent to who gets elected. It's merely a question of the specific promises they offer you in the future. And that's fabulous. That's exactly, you know, the sort of cynical corporate satire of how politics works in the U.S. You know, corporations who give to both major political parties, they're relatively indifferent because the policies at the end of the day will favor them both equally. And so in other games where it's a problem, in this game, it's a plus. Furthermore, there are a whole bunch of things about the game that are desperately unfair, but that are fine because it's hilarious satire. For example, the start player in many player counts has a significant advantage, at least in the first round. And in Corporate America, the start player rule is very simple. It's whoever has the most cash on hand. And so at the start of the game, we all went into our wallets and figured out how much money we had. And so it's almost like paying to win, except, you know, you then get to keep the money, which is fabulous. Another great feature, and I feel almost bad spoiling this, because when we found out this rule in Corporate America, we cackled madly for a long time. But if there is a tie in the presidential election, and the presidential election in Corporate America, of course, is determined by money, if there's a tie, then what happens is there's a deadlock in the Electoral College, and in order to break the tie, you find somebody who's not involved in the game, and they break the tie by whatever means they want. And so you have to find somebody not playing the game, and this represents the Supreme Court. This is sort of a riff on Bush v. Gore. It's absolutely hilarious, and it's really, really cool. So the satire is great. And that's just structurally. There's a whole bunch of cards in Corporate America that are specific jokes that are specific references to companies, because mostly it's about buying and operating companies. So I like the satire. I think it's good. It doesn't seem particularly slanted. It's mostly just making fun of money and politics. And if you don't find that topic funny, then whatever, stay away. As far as the game is concerned, I don't think you, Walker, would like the game. I love it. I think Corporate America is hilarious and great. It's about a 60 to 90 minute haggling game. Sidereal Confluence, which we've talked about before, and I absolutely adore that too. One of the things that I commented on is that it's not really a game that lends itself to haggling, because you want a lot of really smooth transactions. Cube for cube, whatever, I give you these promises. Corporate America is more about haggling. It's like, well, I'll give you $2 for this favor. Eh, make it three. It's like, all right, fine, I'll give you three. It's a lot more about those little finer grain transactions, but it does all the other fundamental things about negotiation games really well. You get differentiation because some people have different interests in different kinds of companies, and so then you want to bribe somebody to make sure that those companies do well. Anyway, it's not the deepest thing in the world. There's a fair amount of craziness, but it's a very, very fun, very good haggling negotiation type game with a great, well-executed theme, and I was completely blown away by how much I enjoyed it. I give it my highest possible recommendation for that kind of niche. Most negotiation games that I like, and I commented this on before when I talked about Sidereal Confluence, are like, you know, 2 hours. And that's a bit draining. But Corporate America is, you know, 60 to 90 minutes, much, much more approachable. Give it a shot if you can track it down. It was great. I love it. I'm looking forward to trying it again.
All right, the only other thing I have on my list is Scythe. And I'm only talking about it because, once again, it was one of the random endings. I'm really liking these random endings because I think they're, when you have newer players or players that don't play very much, it puts a stress on them to get going, right? So the experienced players are going to, like, jump a bunch of stars. You know, once they get their engine going, they're going to be getting two or three, you know, sometimes two stars a turn. So if you put these constraints on them and a sense of urgency, then these other people are going to pick up the pace and also keep up with the more experienced players. Like, the one we played was, as soon as someone gets to $40, the game's over. And every time you get a unique, not a unique, but if you're the first person to put a star on one of the victory conditions, then you would get $5. So everyone felt as though there was this huge push. Even though I was going to get my sixth star on the last turn anyway, like, so it would have been a normal game anyway, it still got everyone up to, you know, the same level at the same time. So I think I'm really enjoying these alternative endings for the Scythe.
That one does look interesting. I thought that was one of the better versions of... I complained before in our review of Scythe of the Wind Gambit that a lot of the alternate end conditions were do this thing or have six stars. And at that point, I'm like, well, you're not really changing much. That, at least, that other condition in the Wind Gambit is at least they're compatible in that every time you well, not every time, but the first time you put a star, you get $5. So if you're putting down lots of stars really quickly, you're going to end up with more money, which will get you there. But there are other ways to get just cash inside. And so I do appreciate opening things up a bit. And I still kind of wish that more of the ending conditions were like that. But I'm glad you're enjoying it. Another new game that we played this week was Mythic Battles Pantheon. This is just starting to ship to backers now. People are getting into their hands. I got mine in trade, so I actually think I got my copy a little bit sooner than some other Canadian backers. Sorry, guys. I feel your pain. But this is a redevelopment, actually, of a previous game simply called Mythic Battles, and we'll talk a little bit more about redevelopment later. But Mythic Battles I thought was fine, and I thought that Pantheon was going to be very much like my friend Alan describes himself, cute but stupid. Alan is at least half right in that characterization of himself, but anyway. And, well, I'll let you start, Walker, because the one play I've had this week was indeed with you. What was your takeaway of Mythic Battles Pantheon?
It's going to be a little skewed on this show because we're big fans of HeroScape. And I think this game really feels a lot like HeroScape because you have all these units that you get to choose from. They do a great... There's this mechanism where they have multiple balancing values. So every unit has a point cost, and every unit puts a number of their own unit cards into the deck, and they also put a certain number of Art of War cards into the deck. So there's three values there that they can use to balance these units out. I think that's a fantastic system.
I was very impressed with how the card play worked out. It was an interesting sort of tension. It was different from many of the standard minis games of the type where you can activate whatever you want, or every turn you just get to activate a couple things, or it was even different from HeroScape, where you can activate any three units in a given turn. It was even different from the Commands and Colors games, which are also card-driven, but the cards activate any unit you want within a certain section. In Mythic Battles Pantheon, if you draft a unit and it has four activation cards, you're in your deck, there will be precisely four times you can activate this unit, and there is no way at all, other than some very, very weird peripheral powers, to activate that unit more than those four times, because once a card is in its discard pile, you're not seeing that again until the reshuffle. And it took me about half of the game, the first play, to really internalize the constraint that that puts on your activation. So in Mythic Battles Pantheon, you can draft the most powerful unit you want, and you can, you know, have Ares or Achilles or whatever big beat stick you have, and you can plop it in the middle of the fight. But I, as your opponent, know there's only a certain number of times you're going to get to activate him, and after that, he's just sitting around waiting to get his rear handed to him. And so you really have to be careful about what you activate and when. And that made things really, really interesting. And it was a lot deeper and more nuanced than I ever expected. Don't get me wrong. I love games where you just get some big unit and you crash it against somebody else. I still love doing stuff like that. I have no end of patience for games like that that do it reasonably quick and dirty. But in Mythic Battles Pantheon, there's another layer there in terms of managing your units and even just the trade-offs of different victory conditions. There are two different ways to win your standard sort of intro scenario, either by killing your opponent's god or by going and collecting different goodies around the map. and different units play into different strategies. You know, as sort of a session report, Walker had a whole bunch of really deadly units, a whole bunch of archers and a titan named Helios who would just wander around and he was massacring me left, right, and center. And I drafted Hermes. And I don't know how much you know about mythology. Hermes was not really known for killing things. He liked to run away. And so there was Walker running around and dominating the center of the map. And here I was running around the periphery and playing a scavenger hunt. It was, like I say, Mythic Battles Pantheon was far more interesting than I thought it was going to be, so I'm very much looking forward to exploring the system.
Definitely in the same boat. I was expecting the worst, but got the best. I'm really looking forward to playing more.
And I love Greek mythology. Their next project, I think, after they reprint this, is going to be Mythic Battles Ragnarok, and Norse mythology is totally my jam. I'm not the wealthiest man in the world, but here's a little sneak peek monolith. If you want to charge me $500 for a scale Jormungand, I would probably give you those $500. I'm a bit weak for those kinds of things. And I already have one plastic mini of Fenris in Blood Rage. But if you want to put a plastic mini of Fenris in Mythic Battles Ragnarok and charge me any number of dollars for it, it would be very hard for me to refuse. But that's enough about my weaknesses. Another game that we played, I played this week, rather, not with Walker because I had fun, so I know he wasn't there, was Galaxy Trucker. I'm a huge Galaxy Trucker fan. This is probably the first design of Vlada Kvatals that I think really brought together all his madness of his whimsy and his crunchy game mechanisms together into something that I think really, really sings on both levels. And this was the first time I was playing Galaxy Trucker with the latest models expansion. The latest models expansion came out almost 5 years ago, but I still haven't had a chance to play it because it requires experienced players. And there aren't a whole lot of experienced Galaxy Truckers around here. I still haven't played the Galaxy Trucker Missions expansion, which is a great tragedy and causes me to weep. But in the latest models, you get to build a, I'd say Death Star, but then we might get a copyright notice. Let's call it a Sphere of Mortality. And the great thing about Galaxy Trucker expansions is every time you add one in, you think you've got a handle on the game. You're at the point where you can fly a ship through a course and not have it fall to pieces and not have it all end in tears. And then you add an expansion and suddenly it's just like you're a beginner again and everything goes to pot on the first card. And my Death Sphere was not pretty by the end of the run. And so you can never be complacent. That is one of the best ways to do expansions as far as I'm concerned. You know, really makes it new for everyone again. And it was good to truck. It's always good to truck. Every time I truck, I wonder why I don't truck more often. My love for it is like a truck berserker. It was great to see Galaxy Trucker again, and I really hope to get more out of all the additional latest models. You're a fan of Trucker, right, Walker?
For sure. I have the app. I enjoy playing it. Very stressful. I like it.
I hear great things about the Galaxy Trucker app, and I've even bought it, and it's installed. Have I ever opened it? No. I just don't. I have a block when it comes to enjoying board games on my phone. I don't know why.
Yeah, the only reason I've played it, I was on a trip recently, and when I'm on the bus or on the plane, that's the only time I ever had it open. Like I said, I've never all of these Tabletopia, and I've installed them all, but have yet to ever play a game on them. It's just I load it up and I just look at it, and you look over on the shelf and you see the game that you can play in person, and you just go on the phone. It's like, yo, let's go play for real, right? And I can't get into it for sure.
I agree completely. I normally would play things like that on public transit and just riding around, but instead now I just listen to podcasts, by which I mean only our podcast, because it's the only one worth listening to.
Of course.
And mostly I just listen to my parts on repeat, and then people ask me to leave because of my moans of pleasure, but it's...
Creepy.
I know. They should just avert their eyes and not pay. Like, yeah, I agree. It's creepy that they're staring.
That's exactly what I meant. Yeah. All right. So finally, in games we played this week, I know what everyone's waiting for. What do we think of Rising Sun? And to that point, we haven't got it yet. And do you know why? Do you hear that down there, mailman? I'm going to let you out when you give me my damn game. He's going to break soon, Mark. I know it.
Walker, I think your plan might be flawed, and here's why. Setting aside the felony convictions, I don't think that he can deliver your game to you if he is indeed locked in your basement.
No, he's got it. He just won't give it to me.
Where would he be hiding?
I don't know.
Okay. That's...
Give me my game.
For those listening, please send help. So, let's talk about the news and why it doesn't matter. What has caught your eye in the news this week, Walker?
pretty well nothing, Mark. The only thing I have here is on the subject of news that surprised no one. Asmodee has bought yet another company.
You don't say.
I do, in fact, say.
Must be a day ending in Y. What do they buy this time?
Just a company called Rebel. It's a Poland, a company from Poland. I believe it's called Rebel Games.
So I've got some strange news. Some of you may have noticed this. There was a bit of a kerfuffle online between Phil Eklund of Sierra Madre Games and Ship Naked. Apparently, who's specifically to blame is a matter of course great disagreement, but Ship Naked sent a whole bunch of the wrong games to the wrong people and or engaged in some incredibly circuitous shipping routes. Like, for example, all the Chinese backers of a certain kind Kickstarter project, all the Kickstarter games were produced in China, shipped out from China, shipped back into China, and then distributed from there, which is fascinating. Anyway, this resulted in Phil Eklund of Sierra Madre. It's basically in terms of the design element, it's a one-man operation. He got sacked with a bill from Ship Naked for $100,000, more or less. He said that the shipping costs for a $37 game turned out on average to be about $25 per backer, which is crazy. And so he had to take this hit out of his savings. And so he posted this on BoardGameGeek. And I will note, just as a note about Phil Eklund, I've made fun of him in the past. I'll probably make fun of him again in the future sometime. Not today, though, because in his rule books, in his editorializing, I find him occasionally borderline obnoxious. He's made some very dismissive comments about my field and other people who work in fields similar to mine. But when it comes to his correspondence on BoardGameGeek, his actual forum posting, he comes across as a very considerate, very humble, very reasonable guy. Usually it's the other way around, right? Usually when you're posting on a message board, you sound like a jerk. And when you have a little bit more time to think about how you're writing, you sound a little bit more measured and reasoned. But I've never met the man. I don't want to judge him personally. I just will say that everything that he's written publicly about these trials have been extremely reasonable, even in the face of tremendous setbacks. Anyway, so a number of people have chimed in talking about their negative experiences with Ship Naked. Bad fulfillment experiences. So the proprietor of Ship Naked, Dan Yarrington, is also the guy who started Game Salute. And a number of people have had very, very bad experiences with Game Salute. Games showing up from Kickstarter fulfillment without boxes or other advertised components, or incredibly late Kickstarter fulfillment. Although, to be perfectly frank, I find it hard to fault anyone for that. That's just kind of par for the course with Kickstarter. But apparently it's
Chinese New Year.
Yeah. Chinese New Year. Apparently, the claim is that when it comes to Game Salute, it's Chinese New Year all the damn time, and it's worse than others, so I'll take people's word for it. But Game Salute has been, very coincidentally, the week after they've been getting slagged on BoardGameGeek for possibly screwing over Phil Eklund, with Dan Yarrington having been found by a jury to be in breach of contract with Zev Schlesinger, formerly of Z-Man, they are now forming three new imprints, and so they'll be publishing games under new names, namely Starling, Sparkworks, and Flying Meeple. I'm sure this is a coincidence. So, again, I haven't had any bad experiences with Yarrington personally. I've had a couple of Kickstarter projects fulfilled by Ship Naked, the Realms projects, for example, and they've been fine. I've had a project fulfilled by Game Salute, namely all the Shadow Rift stuff, and it's been fine. But a lot of people say it's been pretty bad, and I take their words for it. And Yarrington somewhat reasonably refuses to defend himself in public post forums, which is entirely the right call to make. But we as consumers sometimes don't necessarily have the full picture. Suffice to say, there's a lot of mud being thrown around. That's what I've been following in the news.
That's all I've got, too. If you like looking at box covers, lots of companies announced lots of games this week. But like I said, you can go look at the box covers. That's all there is. So, our feature game this week is a game called Gaia Project. Let me tell you about Gaia Project.
Please do.
In Gaia Project, you're going to claim one of 14 asymmetrical alien races, attempting to peacefully colonize the galaxy. And because each race has a different environmental needs, they're going to have to terraform their planets differently. So once you've terraformed your planet, you place a mine there, which is going to be your first building. Then you upgrade your buildings from there and spread throughout the galaxy. There are six different tech tracks that you can modify and improve certain phases and or actions of the game. They give you more resources, making things cheaper, increasing your range. Also getting higher on these tracks will get you more victory points at the end of the game. The final spot in each track only has room for one person, so it's a little bit of a race to get there. There are specific victory point objectives for every turn. These are randomly drawn at the beginning of the game, so it's going to be different from turn to turn and from game to game. And there's also some left over at the end, so there's a big variety there. So in Gaia Project, there are two main objectives, which are also randomly drawn at the beginning of every game. And it's sort of a majority thing. So you either have the most buildings or most power or most of something, and that's tracked throughout the game. So you're going to manage your power, upgrade your buildings, advance in tech, and whoever has the most victory points at the end wins. That is Gaia Project.
What do you think about Gaia Project, Walker?
I really enjoy Gaia Project. I didn't play very much Terra Mystica, I think twice. Once maybe a year ago, and once before that, you know, maybe 3 years ago. But I really enjoy Gaia Project. It's wide open. You have many choices. There's a tech tree, which everyone loves. There are no hidden victory points. The victory conditions are tracked throughout the game. There's no going to be big surprise at the end. You know exactly what everyone has. The asymmetric powers, there's 14. They have the components. They have 7 different colors. Every board is a color. So they have extra components, which are the components are really nice. The molding's nice. The boards are great. All right, I've gone on long enough. Mark, give me some pet counterpoints.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. I don't hate Gaia Project. I'm not going to go and say that it's a terrible design. When it comes to Gaia Project, I'm roughly in the same position that I am with respect to where I was with Empires of the Void 2 or Terraforming Mars. They're fine. They're okay. I just don't quite understand why some people are praising them to the sky. Which, in the case of Gaia Project, I kind of understand why it has its audience. It is, you know, your standard medium-heavy, lots and lots of rules mechanisms Euro game. It doesn't do anything particularly novel, with one major exception, and I will give it praise. The power system is great. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. The way that it deals with power is neat. I mean, it's hardly novel because they invented it for Terra Mystica, so they're using it again in Gaia Project. But it's one problem that I have with it is that it's seriously overcooked. It's, you know, a slew of barely connected mechanisms that is all in service of, at the end of the day, and this is my chief complaint, all that you're doing in this game is you're building buildings. Basically, that's it. Everything else you're doing is in service of building buildings. There's a neat power management system that gives you the resources necessary to build buildings. There's a variety of tech bonuses that you use so as to build buildings. And there's 5 different kinds of buildings. You know, you build your mines and you upgrade them and whatever. But that's it. And so you spend the experience of playing this game is you spend about 120 to about 150 minutes, because it's a substantial game, and all you've got to show for it at the end of Gaia Project is, well, I built these 7 mines, 2 science academies, and this planetary research institute. And that's okay, it's fine, but it doesn't really grab me. I find it very unengaging, and all of this relatively in-depth involved mental combinatorics that requires significant foreplanning, all in the service of just building some buildings. There's not a whole heck of a lot of player interaction. There's a little bit of drafting off of other people's actions. You want to build next to them so you can get some power bonuses, and so your trade institutes are a little bit cheaper. Sure, fine, whatever. And you certainly want to score more points than they do. But even in this game, there's even less blocking than there was in Terra Mystica. The way that the map worked in Terra Mystica was it was a little bit more plausible to try to cut somebody off from valuable terrain. Here, because it's space and there are all these empty spaces in between the planets, in Gaia Project, it's much harder to cut someone off from the edge of the map because if they have the resources to throw at it, they can just bypass. They can bypass you and get past. Not that that's often necessary. And so I'm just underwhelmed. After that much thinking and that much processing and that much rules internalization, I want a little bit more to show for it.
I can't disagree, but I think almost any game can be broken down to the one mechanism.
No, argument. I don't think that's true.
Like spherical confluence, you can say it's all about the trading, right? Or all about the cube pushing.
Sure, but that's a process. Right? The trading and the cube pushing. No, seriously. The trading and the cube pushing is the process. It's how you get, it's the means to the end. In Sidereal Confluence, I will grant you that mostly what you're doing is trading and pushing cubes so as to get victory points. And I agree with you, if I had said, oh, this is a two-hour game where you're just trying to get points. Yeah, that's a nonsense objection. That's just stupid. Because any game with points, at the end of it, your goal is just to get points. But in Sidereal Confluence, the trading and the negotiation and the interaction is all the means so as to get this engine going. And I think that actually the comparison with Sidereal Confluence is a good one, because the next thing I'd like to talk about, and this will give a little bit more, I think, teeth to my complaint that there's not really a whole lot there, is how Sidereal Confluence and Gaia Project handle asymmetry differently. One of my chief problems with Terra Mystica, and I think that Gaia Project still has this, is that the asymmetry doesn't broaden your options, it actually narrows your options. My experience has been that in those games, your racial power isn't so much an additional tool or an additional way for you to explore the game state. It's in fact a set of blinders, because the way you do well in the game is you just hammer home your racial advantage. And so it narrows your available choices rather than expanding them. A counterpoint in Sidereal Confluence, every race can do something kind of neat, and they have a little bit of difference, but that's just grease for the wheels of the negotiation, and it's not the case that blinkers you off and that's all you're going to be doing. If I'm the Unity in Sidereal Confluence, for example, I have my wild resources, yes, and that's my special thing, and that's what I do differently from everybody else, but that's not the only thing I'm doing. I have to make sure that my economy works on a fundamental level past that. In the games, in some of the games, not all of them, and obviously this is great, more or worse for different powers, but in games of Terra Mystica or Gaia Project, if I've got a racial power, that's what I'm supposed to do. So I feel a little bit railroaded. Am I off base?
No, I definitely see what you're saying, but I don't feel that way as strongly as you do. I think the whole game is there. I think there are advantages to your racial abilities. I don't think they handcuff you that much.
It's not a question of handcuffing me. It's just that...
Or I don't think they steer you too badly. I think you can play a normal game. There are definitely some of them that do change the rule setup enough that it is going to railroad you in one direction. But a lot of them give you more options as well.
So let me stick with two examples from Gaia Project. There's the blue race that allows you to build buildings on top of where other people already have buildings. And once you've upgraded your planetary institute, you get bonus points for doing so. And now suddenly, you don't have to worry about building restrictions the way that other people do, and you get a bonus point when you ignore those building restrictions. I'm not claiming it's overpowered. That's not my claim. My claim is that suddenly it's like, oh, wait. So either I can build buildings the normal way, which is more expensive and gives me no points, or I can build buildings in this special way, which is cheaper and gives me points. Well, I guess I'll go do that then. And so I don't feel empowered. I feel like I'm being shown a very specific path and I had best walk it. Or the red race that doesn't form empires the way that other races do. Instead, they form one giant, massive empire and they just agglomerate and agglomerate and agglomerate. If you're not that race, you are forced to build specific different groups of buildings to join them together and form these little empires. Because in Gaia Project, as is in Terra Mystica, you form these subunits of adjacent or connected buildings, and that gives you points. But if you're the red race in Gaia Project, not only is it the case that you don't need to do that. In fact, you can't even really do that. The rules forbid you from doing it. All you have is the one giant metastasizing community. And so as a result, you don't have to diversify. You don't have to seek out new grounds. You're just always just gradually encroaching from your central territory. And that's fine. The powers are cool. But once you take a step back from the powers and you realize, this is the game telling me how to play. This is the game laying out my strategy for me. And that's one of my objections.
Well, it's laying out your strategy, but it's sort of like, it is what a Gaia Project is. It's figuring out the puzzle of the game before the other players. It's like you don't get these abilities right off the hop. You have to get your main building out and figuring out the puzzle to do that before the other players or faster than the other players without making, you know, because it's always a case of cut and loss, right? You know, what are you going to give up in order to do it, right? So, you know, taking the least loss and getting it done faster than the other players.
You do agree, though, that building that Planetary Institute, the one thing that either gives you your racial unique ability or supercharges your racial unique ability, that's more or less a requirement by round two. That's not just me being stupid, right?
No, for sure. The more I play, the more I realize how important it is to get that out earlier rather than later.
Yeah, and that doesn't, as a specific tactical challenge, I agree with you that there's a lot of thinking that going into that and what trade-offs you want to make, and you don't want to bankrupt yourself to do it, et cetera, et cetera. But the fact that that's what you got to do, and then once you've done that, you got to maximize your racial power, because that's pretty much the only way to play competitively. Again, I would rather have a game, let's just compare this to other games that give you special powers or allow you to have special powers. Just, you know, off the top of my head, we both like Scythe. We both think that Scythe is a solid design. The special powers in Scythe don't dictate how you play. They're just ways that you get additional advantages and bonuses in certain situations. It doesn't specifically say only seek out those situations, because that's just not how the game works. Agricola is the same way. You get situational bonuses based on the end. You can try to supercharge your engine with these situational bonuses, but that's not the only engine that you can pursue, or Cosmic Encounter or Sidereal Confluence or whatever. When there are special powers, I like them to liberate me, not give me a specific path, a narrow path that I have to tread.
Maybe that's just the design choice they wanted to go with. Make it, you know, make them more distinct, right? The more power you give the racial abilities, the more distinct they'll feel, maybe.
That's true. But again, going back to Cosmic Encounter, I know you hate the game, and that's fine. It's legitimate. There are many games I like that I think are illegitimate to dislike. Cosmic Encounter isn't one of them. But in Cosmic Encounter, you have to agree that the asymmetry is huge. You know, the special powers in Cosmic Encounter are so game-breaking as to be defining the game. But you're not, when playing a certain alien, I don't feel like the game is telling me how to play.
No, for sure. Not during the entire gameplay. When it comes down to what that alien, that specific in Cosmic Encounter, the alien powers, when they're engaged, like they apply to a specific phase of the game. You know what I mean? Like they're really good at that particular point. So you're right; it doesn't over encompass like it does in Gaia Project, where it pretty well takes over your whole turn or your whole direction. But I just think that is a design choice they decided to make.
Sure. In your plays, I know we're both not incredibly deep into the game, because there are people who've played Terra Mystic hundreds of times, literally, because of the fact that you can play it online. So there's vast amounts of data. The consensus is, in Terra Mystica, that some of the races are decidedly imbalanced. You know, there's the view that, from people whose opinions I trust, that if you want to play Terra Mystica competitively, like seriously competitively, you have to bid for factions. There's no other way to do it. How have your experiences been so far with faction balance?
I don't think I've played enough. I think it's fine so far in the number of times that I've played it. I haven't seen a race that, you know, it's much like the Buildings or Orleans, where at first you think it's overpowered, and then, you know, once you get through a certain part of the game or a certain phase of the game, you know, they're strong at first, but then they peter out type thing, or they're weak at the beginning and get stronger near the end. So far, they seem fairly balanced.
Sure. Are you worried at all by the track record of Terra Mystica?
No,
okay.
Not at all.
That's legitimate.
Like I've been waiting for a Terra Mystica game. Like I got Lisboa hoping that it would be our Terra Mystica game. I'm looking for a game that our group plays frequently. Like we're in this cult of the new, I don't want to say rut, right? Where we're just playing new game after new game, right? And hardly anything ever comes back to the table.
We're journalists now, Walker.
I know. We
can't play games to have fun.
We have to sacrifice for our public, I know.
Yeah, we always have to play the newest thing because otherwise no one's going to care.
All right, I do have negatives as well. Let's see. No combat. Player interaction.
Does everything have to have combat,
no,
Walker?
I'm not saying it has to have combat. I'm just saying that... No, it's part of this point, is that the fact that there's no combat, i.e. there's no real player interaction.
Sure.
It's the fact that the only interaction is...
There is a bit.
I'm going to go over what there is. There's the snatching the planet.
No. Let me tell you what you think.
You shut your mouth.
No. Here's the way it works. You start a sentence with a couple of words, and then I cut you off responding to what I think you're going to say. That's called communication, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
All right. So, snatching planets... Before the other players do, racing up the tech tree, like trying to get to the top before other players, and taking the power actions. There's a row of power actions like Terra Mystica and what we call QIC actions. And you have to admit that the QIC tokens are one of the best components ever in board game history.
They are pretty cool, yeah.
So those are the only ways you can pretty well interact, is taking like normal, you know, solo worker placement interaction things, taking things before the other players do.
That actually is probably, when playing Gaia Project, that's probably where I feel the player interaction the most. people snagging the QIC or power actions before I can, because they are pretty good. When it comes to snatching planets from other people, again, because of the way the different races are set up, I feel like it's usually so grotesquely expensive for me to go take a planet that's good for you, I might as well just go take the planet that's good for me anyway. And even if I do block you, quote-unquote block you, I'm probably not going to block you too badly, because then you just might have to throw a couple more QICs to get the extra range to go somewhere else. Racing up the tech track as well, I've never, and this was true of the old cult tracks in Terra Mystica as well. Terra Mystica had these cult tracks, and they were kind of awkward in a game that's already pretty awkward. It's a whole bunch of different mechanisms shackled together without a whole bunch of thematic cohesion or coherence. Gaia Project's tech tracks are definitely superior to the cult tracks. I'll give them that. But the fact that only one player can get to the very top, you generally don't see a huge race for that, because typically what happens is you can only focus on a couple of tech tracks at most. And what are the odds that there's going to be serious competition for that very, very highest level? I haven't seen it manifest much. So I it is an element of player interaction, but I don't think it's particularly pronounced.
No. And I also have, well, you talked about the power system. At first, I felt it was very fiddly and added on, but the more that I play it, I really feel like it is an intricate part of this game. It really ties all of the other mechanisms together. Like, everything sort of gives you power. When you build buildings close to people, it sort of, you know, encourages this interaction, you know, working it out between your other players. And it's on the tech tree, and it's on, you know, there's so many ways you can interact with this power thing. I always thought it was like it felt added on, but the more I play it, the more I like it, for sure.
They've definitely, I think a lot of the new powers in Gaia Project, the new races in Gaia Project, rather, make much better use of the power track. So let's just explain for people who are unfamiliar. The way that it works in both of these games, you have these three bowls, and you have these tokens that move between the three bowls. And every time you gain power, if you have something in bowl one, it goes to bowl two. Once bowl one is empty, things from bowl two move to bowl three. And once they're in bowl three, you can spend them. There are ways that you can game this advancement. You can start burning tokens to advance tokens faster. So there's this notion of tokens coming in and out of your system, which is, in turn, I find especially interesting, because you don't want the system to be too full of tokens. You don't want too many, because then your income gets diluted. If I have 6 tokens total in my ecosystem and I get, you know, 6 power, well, that moves all my tokens. That helps me get towards the point where I can use the tokens. If I've got 20, well, then I'm not going to be able to use any of them until I've generated a staggering amount. On the other hand, if I have too few, that's a problem. So that sort of managing your power, I do find really interesting. And they've done a much better job of making that system a little more fluid. In Terra Mystica, you almost never gained or lost tokens into your bowls. But in Gaia Project, there's a whole bunch of different ways to do that. And so that, I think, was a definite step forward, and I definitely enjoy it. And it's the primary element of flexibility. There are 3 currencies in the game. 3 core currencies, plus there's this notion of power, and power can get you pretty much anything. It's like a better, more sophisticated version of rubies from Caverna. It's not a wild resource, but it's a thing that, if you manage it properly, can get you that little extra thing you're missing, and so it can help compensate for your economy. So I don't really have much bad to say about power. I think it's a great system, and I think that it's been integrated much better in Gaia Project.
That's all my points for Gaia Project.
So another thing, though, about Gaia Project I think is a little bit problematic is I don't like how there's early game snowballing. It is absolutely one of those games where if you mess up your first turn, you can be done, especially if you build the wrong building too soon. Again, this is entirely a game about building buildings and upgrading those buildings. And if you spend too much upgrading buildings incorrectly, your income is just kneecapped. And to a certain extent, your ability to progress in the game is a function of your least good income set. And so if you just do a bad job of setting things up in rounds 1 and 2, that's it. You're pretty much done. There's not really a way to come back. There's no catch-up mechanism, which is fine by itself, but this is very much a plodding game of near-perfect information of just gradually expanding your buildings. And so in a game that's 2+ hours, I can find that somewhat unfortunate. And, you know, when you combine that with a limited player interaction, I feel like I'm just kind of solving a spreadsheet, more or less. Let me sort of sum this up with a somewhat weird, but I think very, very apt comparison. When I'm playing this game, or when I'm at least thinking about Gaia Project and thinking about its shortcomings, the game that I'm reminded of, in terms of a game that did something similar really well, is Through the Desert, the Reiner Knizia tiling classic. Here's why. In Through the Desert, you're similarly, all you're doing is you're just putting out camels. You're expanding your presence. It doesn't have any notion of income. It doesn't have any notion of special powers, and it doesn't have any notion of all those other elaborate subsystems that Terra Mystica and Gaia Project layer onto themselves. But what you get in exchange, because of the way Through the Desert is designed, is you get so much more player interaction, and you get so much more tension in terms of tempo and in terms of geographical situation. Gaia Project is, again, it's just about a game about expanding your presence and building out more buildings. So is Through the Desert. But Through the Desert is tense, it's fast, and I'm constantly butting up against the expansionist efforts of all my fellow players. And so when I'm playing Through the Desert, I don't look at it and wish that there was an elaborate income scheme, elaborate system of marginal special powers, or I wish that there was some kind of unique path that only I could follow that no one else can. Because again, that limits the interaction, not heightens it. That limits the range of choices, not expands it. And so in a way, when I look at a lot of these games that are these medium-heavy Euro games with lots of economic systems where at the end of the day, all you're doing is just plopping up buildings, I end up wondering why I'm not playing Through the Desert. And I was wondering if you think I'm insane for making that comparison.
Not for you personally. Like, if that's the way you feel, then there's nothing I can say. Like, I personally think you're crazy, but I'm allowed to feel that way.
Okay.
I really think Gaia Project is just a game about figuring out puzzles faster than your opponents.
Yeah, but so is Through the Desert.
Very short term, correct.
Yeah, obviously, look, they're operating on different timescales. But that's, again, one of the virtues of a game that gets the same element of engagement, but faster.
But I think the scale of time invested to feeling good about, you know, what you've done is there. Like, if you make one, you know, good move in Through the Desert, yeah, it's a good move. But if you know, like, through these past three turns, you've worked up to this point in Gaia Project, it gives you much more satisfaction than you would get through the Desert.
For you, maybe. For me, it's the other way around. After playing Gaia Project for 2 full hours, and I look down and I'm like, oh, I put out 6 mines, a couple of research institutes, and trading post. Okay. That doesn't give me a profound sense of satisfaction. But when I cut somebody off in Through the Desert, when I make that play that they didn't see coming and suddenly they can't get to that oasis, I get a certain amount of thrill from that. I'm not saying they're the same game where they satisfy the same, even that they satisfy the same design space. What I'm saying is that a game of Through the Desert in many ways captures all the good things that I think Gaia Project sometimes aims for and doesn't get to.
I see where you're going.
You know,
but I don't want to come along.
There's a first time for anything. And finally, we've gotten to the episode where Walker was more condescending than me. I didn't know that it was possible. Thank you for joining us on this journey. I might have to go kill myself because obviously everything that I know to be true is false.
Condescending? That's hurtful. All right. So if you like puzzle games, long space non-combat Euros, then Gaia Project will be for you.
Yeah, maybe.
On to our topic, which is totally related. Gaia Project is a reskinning of Terra Mystica. And from what I've heard and from what I've played, it is very, very similar. And how does this, as a consumer, make us feel? How, as a company, should you go forward with doing these types of practices? Is this in the best interest for our hobby? We're going to bring up some, as far as I know, like usual, we just have a topic name and we go in our own directions and we sort of merge it all together in some weird semi-stewing pot of awful logic.
That sounds delicious.
Yeah, I know. It's so delicious. All right, so let's just start with what we're on right now. There's two games, actually. Let's just do them both sort of at the same time because it's sort of the same thing. Clank is sort of a fantasy type setting, and then Clank in Space came out almost right after. Same with Terra Mystica, fantasy type setting. Then Gaia Project, reskinning in space. How does this make you feel as a consumer, Mr. Bigney?
So, as a consumer, I accept the fact that game design, especially in the Eurogame space, is very iterative. Namely, you are relying on the design work that's gone before. And I look at the evolution of Terra Mystica to Gaia Project very much in the same way that I look at the evolution of, for example, Uwe Rosenberg's worker placement games or in the evolution of deck builders. There are lessons that are learned, and once those lessons are learned or demonstrated very well in a design, they're frequently adapted into future designs. So I kind of like that. That having been said, if I were you know, into Terra Mystica in terms of its base game and its expansion, would I want to rebuy the game? Well, that depends. It depends on how significant the gameplay advances are. It depends on how I feel about the new theme. I do appreciate that these innovations are being made. I object somewhat to your term use of the term reskin, because I think there's a difference between a reskin and a redevelopment. A reskin is when you take the game and you change nothing except the graphical underpinnings. And you could have made a sci-fi themed game that was exactly the same as Terra Mystica, right? You could have just changed the graphics. They didn't do that. They actually went and they rethought about the mechanisms. Now, they didn't rethink about the mechanisms specifically in terms of sci-fi. It's very clearly the case that this isn't a heavily thematic experience. They were just tinkering around the edges and they just made things hang together a little bit better. And so I appreciate that. But I think just to call it a straight reskin is doing a bit of disservice.
I suppose I'm wondering if I looked at the weaknesses that Terra Mystica had and brought up this new product, right, and thought how best to present this. And decided to put it in a science fiction setting.
Yeah, I prefer when that kind of development work can be done with expansions, when a new expansion can really sort of serve to address fundamental game imbalances. For example, Fantasy Flight in the mid-aughts had this habit of releasing terribly, terribly broken games and then fixing them not with new additions, but with expansions. And you know, say what you want about how impermissible it is to release a broken game. At least if you're going to go fix it, try to fix it in terms of expansion material so that there's minimal cost of entry for the consumer. Now, ideally, what you do is you ship replacements to all your original purchasers so you don't have to worry about it at all. But, you know, you're not going to do that. So the classic example of that is Game of Thrones, right? The first edition of Game of Thrones was more or less broken out of the box with some pretty degenerate strategies. And the first expansion is considered practically a necessity because it addresses those things. So, but that having been said, if instead your approach is to do a second edition, which is Fantasy Flight's new strategy, right? That's what they do now. They put a second edition on everything, possibly, you know, sometimes only a few years after the first edition was sold. You know, again, I'm of two minds. I like that this development work is being done. I find it interesting from a game design perspective to see how these problems are being addressed. But sometimes I hate having to buy the same product twice.
And then we have two different designers like Eric Lang and Uwe Rosenberg who have the same design process but come out with completely different games as they move along this same sort of theme, right? We have Uwe Rosenberg with, you know, with the puzzle placement. You know, he's got Patchwork, he's got Indian Summer, and he's got
Cottage Garden.
And so instead of just, you know, reskinning the same thing or doing new additions, he comes out with complete new games. He brings in other mechanisms in order to bring out a different game for us to play. So in the case of Eric Lang, he went from Midgard to Blood Rage. And now he's gone from Blood Rage to Rising Sun. So instead of bringing out new additions or expansions, he's taken what he felt is best from these games, made an entirely new game, and gave us something new to play.
You think there's a straight line in terms of development process between Blood Rage and Rising Sun? Because I don't really see... Yeah, they've got the same artist and the same publisher and it's the same designer, but I don't really see any solid gameplay connections. One of them is a drafting game. The other one's a role selection game. They don't... I mean, there's not a whole lot of overlap.
Well, from what I've seen so far, because of course you down there won't give me my game, is that you are drafting from these orders that you're going to be playing every turn. You are bringing in these gods to help you in each territory. I think there are quite a few similarities, and even he said, you know, I know he said at the beginning, he said it was a sister of Blood Rage. I know that was long, early in the design process, and I'm sure it's veered, you know, largely from what his first vision, but...
Okay, well, once we actually played Rising Sun, we can actually comment on what we think the design similarities are. I think it was more in terms of an aesthetic continuity and a publishing continuity rather than a design continuity, but we can have that disagreement later. Sometimes I think that we should be happy that we're not getting more straight reskins, just new window dressing, because, you know, that's usually pretty unfortunate. I would like to point out one exception, though. I am a big fan of one reskinning. There was the original trilogy edition of Risk, Star Wars original trilogy Risk, which is actually a decent game, which was given a straight reskin into Mass Effect Risk. And I actually think it's better as Mass Effect. I've commented on this before. The victory conditions make more sense, and I think the factions are better. So sometimes, by accident, you can end up with a better product with more thematic coherence and thematic integration. But usually, instead, all that you get is, you know, like The Walking Dead Monopoly, which, you know, makes no sense.
Yeah, that's the other end of the spectrum is the total consumerism of it, where we have like 50 different, you know, monopolies and clues and all the rest of it.
Yeah, they're not really for us, though. They're not really marketed towards us.
All right, then we have another line, which would be the Zombicide line. So we have Zombicide and its crazy number of expansions, and then right into Black Plague, and then right into Green Horde, which is very much all of the same mechanisms again. And on top of that, Massive Darkness, right, which also doesn't veer very far from the line. So all of these games, very similar. It feels very much like a churning commercialism,
yeah,
cult of the new money grab.
Massive Darkness was the first time I felt that they really made a solid effort to change the system significantly. So Zombicide to Black Plague, they're incompatible systems, so you can't use all the components together, but really it's fundamentally the same experience. Not a whole lot was done. And I'll agree with you, that's just a question of, you know, selling more plastic to people who want more plastic. And that's fine, I have nothing against that. It's just, you know, not for me in that system. Massive Darkness, I think, was a little bit more interesting. Sometimes... it's, you know, sometimes I love me the second editions. Sometimes second editions do something really genuinely interesting. Like, for example, I think that the second edition of Battle Lore that Fantasy Flight put out is an interesting addition to the Commands and Colors line. I like all the other Commands and Colors games, but I think that the second edition of Battle Lore is the most different of all of them, and most of the changes, I think, are solid, interesting game design choices. So in cases like that, where you're really going to iterate a system and really give us something radically new, I think is great. I am also a sucker for the second edition of Rum and Bones. I'm more or less alone on this, and you can all sneer, but you're all wrong. I love me the second edition of Rum and Bones. I thought the first one was great. I think the second one's even better. That's an instance of a designer really paying attention to what people didn't like about the first version and really trying to reiterate on the design. But this actually dovetails with another question that I have, and that is, you know, just to address the different ways to handle early adopters. Because we as early adopters often get the shaft. You know, having to, you know, I've already said I hate having to buy the same product twice. And in the context of genuinely new entries into a system like Battle Lore Second Edition, that's fine. I don't feel like, because I have Command and Colors Napoleonics or even Battle Lore First Edition, that, you know, Battle Lore Second Edition is really sticking a thumb in my eye. But when it comes to something like, the most egregious example being something like a new printing, sometimes there's just a new printing, and so the new expansions won't be compatible with the old things. That happened with Galaxy Trucker back in the day. There was the very first printing of Galaxy Trucker was completely incompatible with all the expansions. So they tried to put out a component upgrade pack or whatever to bridge the gap, but it was expensive and incredibly limited distribution. I wasn't able to find one, so I had to rebuy the thing. Well, I traded my old copy away and got something else in exchange, so I wasn't totally hosed. But that really, really is unfortunate. But sometimes that also happens with edition changes as well. An example of a game we both like is Shadow Rift. Shadow Rift first edition, I as an early adopter got that version, and then all the new expansions are now only compatible with the second edition of Shadow Rift. To give credit where credit is due, the designer Jeremy Anderson made the second edition of Shadow Rift available at cost for people who had the first edition, so kudos to him on that. But there are a lot of publishers who aren't so generous or so considerate, and then there are a whole lot of people who are left holding the bag.
Well, Iron City comes to mind. I know a couple of people who got the first edition of Iron City, and then only a few years later, they bring out a second edition with no, you know, compensation for the first early adapters, like you say.
Yeah, which is weird, because Ryan Laucat did, in many ways, the textbook example of how to fix a game right, because Empires of the Void, the first Empires of the Void, not the second one, which is in no way even a re-edition or a second edition of Empires of the Void 1, but we've talked about that before. Empires of the Void 1 had a free print-and-play expansion, which is one of the best expansions I've played in terms of fixing perceived issues with the base game. And that he just gave for free. So it's, you're right. Sometimes even the same publisher or the same designer can do the entire spectrum from the best to the worst.
Now, do you think there's like a time limit that there should be on from first to second editions or anything like that?
I agree that it's not very classy if you release a new edition very shortly after the first one and you make zero effort to allow early adopters to upgrade their copy. For a while in war games, this was a serious problem, because in a lot of war games, and I'm talking about the historical stuff here, you know, GMT and MMP and publishers like that. But now, GMT especially is now very, very, very good. If there are problems with the rulebook, if there's a living rulebook, if the map gets corrected, if some cards get corrected, whatever, they almost invariably now give you a very cheap or at-cost upgrade pack so you could bring your first edition components up to second edition. So they're very good at taking care of their customers that way. And there have been, you know, better and worse ways to do it, and I agree that the time is a factor. It's tough to tell. It's a balance. I just think that as a publisher, if your new edition is to deal with genuine problems in the first, you should make an effort to make sure that your consumers are taken care of. If it's the case that new expansions are only going to be compatible with one of the two editions, try to make sure you take care of your consumers.
Yeah, Flames of War did a great job of that. If you brought in your old rule book and you gave it to the, you know, your local shop dealer, he would give you like the new rule book for free. They did a great job. Then the next thing I want to talk about is the other side of the coin, which is Games Workshop.
Mm.
Right, and their miniature system and how they bring out edition after edition. And sometimes they purposely change the codexes to make your old models obsolete. They're enforcing you to buy the new models.
It's the same thing as CCGs. Every wave, or a lot of the new competitive games from Fantasy Flight, every wave seeks to obsolete the past wave. So there you're kind of locked into a system where it's not even a question of a second edition. It's a question of the 17th edition and the 18th edition and the 19th edition. And you have to remain current or you're going to get left behind. That's one of the reasons why I don't play those games anymore.
Well, that might sound negative, but there is another side to that as well, is that it shows that they're supporting that system, right?
Well,
sometimes people put out games and then that's it. It's out there. They don't touch it anymore. They don't keep intact. They don't update the rules. They don't do anything. And that's it. This sort of shows that they're there. They're supporting their product. You know, they're putting in the effort to make it better over and over again. But I know it's obvious they have shareholders and they are there to make the money. And like everything else we're saying, you know, you can either buy these things or not. This is, you know, we're just talking, you know, is this good for the market or not?
But there's a better way and a worse way to do it. When you release a second edition and you change a whole bunch of cards, try to offer an upgrade pack. Whether it's at cost or even if you make a profit off it, whatever. I realize it's hard when you're talking about a very, very small number of units to do those things. But I'm sorry, you kind of owe it to your fans, and it's a good way to pay it forward so that people can invest in your products, knowing full well that if they change, they're not going to get the shaft. When Fantasy Flight basically brings down the Nerf hammer on a unit and makes its card, whether this is Imperial Assault, whether it's Netrunner, whether it's X-Wing or whatever, they don't offer replacement cards. That's a problem for me, especially given that in competitive tournament environments, there's a very strong bias towards using original cards. I don't know the best way to handle it, but when they don't try to do anything to address it, then that's a problem and I object.
Even Dominion, how old is Dominion? And they recently updated their thing and they offered an upgrade pack.
Exactly.
They did a great job.
I have no problem, and this is one of the things where and a number of designers are better or worse at this. When you show up and say, "Hey guys, I've got a second edition. I've changed all these things," and then people say, "Okay, well, what about my first edition copy?" There's often this very douchey, sort of passive aggressive, disingenuous reply. It's like, "Oh, I'm sorry for making my game better. I guess I should have just left it be broken." It's like, no, shut up. Take care of the people who've invested in your product, and a lot of people, this is actually a line that that David Serlin and a lot of his fans invoke all the time. David Serlin's the guy who did Yomi and Puzzle Strike and a whole bunch of related games in that universe. They're like, "Oh, well, you know, I take game improvement very seriously." It's like, well, look, everybody does. Every game designer takes these things seriously. Don't pass off your obsoleting my old copies or you know, leaving these previous editions incompatible with Futures Expansion just as your devotion to purity. And pretending as though other people don't. And furthermore, don't compare it, and this is specifically the thing I have against David Serlin, he often compares it to video games. It's like, "Oh, well, they update all the time." It's like, yeah, most of the time when they upgrade, it's free. And when it's not free, people complain. And guess what? That's the exact same situation you're in here. If you want to charge me $20 for a Yomi upgrade pack, fine, go ahead. That's great. Or even just connect it to a print-on-demand service. You don't even have to offer a new SKU. You don't need to stock anything. Just set up an account with one of the infinite number of print-on-demand services and just be able to give me a click on a link, and I'll order it from them. That's fine. I'll do that too. But if you're not going to bother at all, then that's an issue. This actually happened recently with the new edition of Gloomhaven. There are a number of cards that got fixed in Gloomhaven. Some of the classes got rebalanced. The class that I recently retired in Gloomhaven, no spoilers, turns out got nerfed rather significantly, which kind of explains because he was pretty badass. But anyway, and people are asking for just a PDF of the corrected cards. It currently exists in text format, right? There's the errata on a forum thread or what have you. And people are just saying, hey, would you mind putting it together in a PDF of corrected cards so I could download and print it? They haven't yet. They say they will. So good on them. You can do it in a more or less classy way, and you can do it in a more or less difficult way to make sure that your fans are taken care of. That's all I'm saying.
All right. I have one other game, Eclipse. And due out this year is Eclipse 2nd Edition.
Yeah, I don't know, man. We'll see.
Well, these are things that I'm... These are reasons why I like it. See, I never owned Terra Mystica, and I wanted to. And then the Gaia Project, I could get that. Clank came out. I never bothered to pick it up. I was away when it was released. I came back, and look, Clank in Space is out. So I, get the newest, greatest thing.
Sure.
I never got to get Eclipse. Everyone else had it. Now, 2nd Edition out, I can pick it up. And in all these cases, fortunately, I am not going to be on the downside.
It is worth noting that that is one of the benefits of Kickstarter. Early adopters now have one way in which they're privileged over late adopters. I mean, yes, you're a late adopter, so you get the best version of whatever someone buys. At least now the early adopters get Kickstarter exclusives. And so I'm not suggesting that it's tit for tat, but at least there's some sort of balance. I'm going to withhold judgment on Eclipse 2nd Edition until it comes out. I think... There are some re-editions. I just want to give credit where credit is due for some re-editions that take the re-theme seriously and think about how to make it better. And that is, I've reviewed this game before, it's Star Trek Frontiers. Star Trek Frontiers is sort of Andrew Park's spin on the Mage Knight board game. And they looked at things seriously and said, okay, well, what are some of the mechanical differences we can make to better model the fact that these are starships flying through space with crews instead of some sort of semi-immortal god king wandering around murdering everybody? And they did that through away missions and a subtle nudge to the diplomacy system. And in so doing, they managed to correct a perceived imbalance in the base game, because in the base game at some point in Mage Knight, diplomacy becomes borderline useless. But in Star Trek, diplomacy remains useful for the entire time because you're not always shooting people. Sometimes you're negotiating, even with final bosses. And it also just fits with the theme better. In Star Trek, they were always negotiating with weird alien races. And so it works. And so I think that if you're doing a second edition or if you're doing a re-theme, there are ways to do it intelligently to make the product not just better in terms of smoothing out the perceived problems, but if you're going to re-theme it, you can also just make it substantially better. What I'm looking forward to most, and I wish more redevelopments would work this way, is, and this I think is really just the sign of a master designer at work, and that is the evolution between Tigris and Euphrates and Yellow and Yangtze, because they maintain some of the same core ideas, but they're radically different. And that's an indication of the kind of design work that Reiner Knizia can do. He can take the same core concepts and spin it out into a very different experience. It looks, again, we haven't played Yellow and Yangtze, but it really does look like it's going to be vastly more different.
I think it's a little too soon. I think 10 years is a little early for a second edition.
It's been more than 10 years.
Yeah, I know. It was just a shot in the dark.
It's closer to 20.
Nice.
Yeah, I mean, and at the end of the day, that's where I'm at. I like looking at this renewed development work. I like it when a designer returns to their earlier work and elaborates on those threads with either the new lessons they've learned or with progress in the market, either in terms of game components or game mechanics. And if I like a game enough, I will buy it two or maybe even three times. But I feel like a sucker for doing it. I wish we could get it right the first time, but I recognize that it's not often possible. At least, as I say, now we have... Early adopters do have the benefit of Kickstarter exclusives now. That is one way in which the market gives them a little bit of goodness for all the times that they get shafted.
Agreed.
Well, that just wraps it up for So Very Wrong About Games. Thank you very, very much for joining us. We appreciate it a great deal, even though we like to make fun of you. You can find us on Facebook. That's the best way to get in touch with us collectively. If you want to drop a comment there, we will get back to you if we can. If you'd like to email one of us individually, you can reach Walker at justrolledadice@gmail.com. That's justrolledadice@gmail.com. You can find me, Mark Bigney, on Twitter at allthegamesyoulike. Until we talk to you again, we hope you have a good week in gaming. And if you get a copy of Rising Sun before we do, we hate your guts.
Very much so.
Until next time, guys.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Biggin. Special thanks goes to What Does It Eat for generously allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our theme. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. You can reach us by email at soverywrongaboutgames@gmail.com or on Twitter at sowronggames. Thanks very much, see you next time, and always, try to be right, but remember you are so very wrong.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.